Following is a conversation with Alan Arnett. Alan is a coach, a keynote speaker, a mountaineer, and an Alzheimer's advocate. He summited Everest in 2001 and became the oldest American to summit K2 at the age of 58 on his birthday, July 27, 2014. Alan has been cited as one of the world's most respected chroniclers of Everest by Outside Magazine. Summit Coach, his ongoing company, is a consulting service that helps aspiring climbers throughout the world achieve their goals. His blog and website at alanarnett.com is a must-see for anyone interested in anything Everest or the 8,000-meter peaks and beyond. I've used that website, blog, and research area countless times when in need of stats or updates on recent events. He has a podcast on his website as well as a YouTube page. I ask Alan about Everest, the state of Everest. Is it being degraded by too many people going there, by too many firsts, too many people trying to do things differently there? His answer is plain and honest, but in true Alan style, he ends it on a positive and hopeful note. He also speaks about the climate crisis confronting us and the future of climbing. If you haven't already, please take a moment to subscribe to this channel, comment and like this video. Let me know what you think. Thank you.
You're where people go for information. You've logged information, facts and figures. How many bodies are on Everest? How many summits have there been? How many multiple summits have there been? And that's saying something, because you're a source for people to learn the information and the facts they know, but you also have that emotional component.
Yeah, I mean, so first off, you know, give all credit to the Himalayan database and to, you know, the late Elizabeth Holly and Billy Berling and the whole Richard Salisbury, that whole group that just does yeoman's work in cataloging, at least in Nepal and the Tibet 8,000ers and other mountains. So, you know, they're really where I get a lot of that raw data. But to your point, I also think that there's more to climbing than just numbers, and there's more to climbing than just standing on top of a summit, you know, beating your chest, declaring victory and going home and telling people, yeah, I summited Everest. I was all by myself. By the way, I didn't use boots. I went up a route that's never been climbed before, and I carried all of my gear in from India. You know, people exaggerate so much these days on social media that it's really, I think, diluting the integrity of the sport. So what I have tried to do from the very beginning, when I first started my website, alanarnett.com, pretty original, huh?
But easy to remember.
Some guy told me I should change the name because it's hard to spell and nobody knows who Alan Arnett is. So I said, I'll keep going with this path. I started in 1999 as a family website, and I quickly saw the dark side of the internet when people were stealing pictures of our daughter and things like that. So I changed over to just chronicling my climbs and then being very authentic and transparent. So, you know, if I tried to climb a mountain, whether it was a 14er or a Shishapangma or whatever, and I gave up or I threw up or I fell down or whatever, I just told it like it was. So I think that I began to develop a reputation for being just telling it like it is. And you know what? I wasn't trying to convince anybody of anything. And I'm not to this day. I'm just trying to give information, share my personal experiences, and inviting people to take from that, tease from that, whatever they want. And I think that emotion, as you noted earlier, is part of what I help bring to people, that they understand that climbing is not a mechanical act. It is a whole essence. It's your mind, it's your body, it's your spirit, it's your soul. You know, it is mental toughness, it's physical, the ante to be, you know, strong enough physically, but mostly it comes down to, just Can you manage your emotions going through the process in the worst of times and the best of times in order to tease the best out of that experience and to come home what I consider to be a better version of yourself because you've learned through going through that suffering? And that's where the emotion comes from.
Hey, Alan, let me ask you real quick. And now that we kind of got the emotional and spiritual part, talked about a little bit. What is the future of Everest and where's it going? And in that question, have things gone too far? Are there too many people trying to be the first to be a person to climb it with this certain ailment or lack of certain limb or something like that? And not to diminish one iota that, but it's kind of getting a little bit overrun. And I think that for, as an inside guy, even it's tiring a little bit to see. So what is the state of Everest as we know it? And let's maybe take Nepal, because China does things a little differently, keeps it a little bit cleaner over there, literally and figuratively. So where are we at?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated question. And I think that people like you and me have to be very careful not to be judgmental or to be the get off my lawn old man, you know, that back in my day, you know, I think we have to be careful about that. And I think we have to be honest and candid about the state of affairs. What we're seeing these days on Everest, in this guy's humble opinion, is that we're seeing way too many people that are being seduced by clever marketing, primarily from the large Nepali companies that come say, you know, you don't need to spend $65,000, $75,000. You can do it for $30,000, $35,000, $25,000. And you don't need a lot of experience because we will teach you everything you need to know on the mountain. And so sadly, there's a lot of Indian nationals, especially young Indian nationals, that are falling for that line. And I talked about this a lot after the 2019 season. And I spoke with a lot of people in India, from very respected climbers to journalists to just your everyday person. And I kept hearing the same thing, that in India, there is this cultural phenomenon that if you go to Everest and you summit, I mean, you're a hero. You come home and you are rewarded with cash and land. I don't know any other country that does that. There's some stuff in Pakistan, but India really excels. And if you die on Everest, you become a martyr for the rest of your life. And then your family celebrates your martyrdom for centuries. So there's this strange phenomenon going on. That said, this year we saw multiple people from India summit multiple 8,000 meter mountains, which leads me to a broader point that the style of which Everest is being climbed today and the other 8,000 meter mountains, and sadly, even K2, has dramatically changed from what it was even 5 years ago, dramatically from 10 or 15 years ago, and astronomically from what people were doing with national teams back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. These days, you sign up with a team, the Sherpas go. They plow the route to the summit. And this applies to almost every single one of the biggest mountains in the world, including even Aconcagua, where they're starting to use supplemental oxygen. And so the Sherpas, they put in the fixed lines, they put in the camps, they stock it with food, fuel, oxygen. The clients typically stay at base camp. Maybe they do one rotation instead of the three that traditionally people like you and I have done, or even four. Sometimes they'll acclimatize on a Lobuche or an island peak, you know, they'll get to 20,000 feet. But then when everything is all ready and there's a good weather forecast, you know, they go, they clip into the fixed ropes and off they go. They start using oxygen now well below 7,000 meters, which below at camp three was the line of demarcation. Now they start using it at camp two and some even at camp one. At running at 4 to 6, and in some situations, even up to 8 liters per minute. So all of a sudden, all of the things that cause climbing these big mountains to become a very physical and mental challenge, and it tested you to your core, slowly but surely, the teams are just mitigating all of those challenges. And we're seeing more and more people summit. And you know what? I'm thrilled to death for them, because I think, you know, I always say that whatever your reason is unique and personal to you. And, you know, go celebrate, go do your summit and go home, but also be candid, be transparent about the style in which you summited. And, you know, there's two groups in my mind. There's recreational climbers, and then there's professional climbers / record seekers. If you're a recreational climber, I don't give a rat's ass, you know, when you started using oxygen. If you're a professional sponsored, being paid, or you're trying to set a record or claim something, you're trying to set something that you claim no one else has ever done, and you're not playing by the same rules as your predecessors, shame on you.
Yeah, right. I completely agree. Alan, also, one thing that I noticed, particularly in 2016, it was starting to show itself in 2014, but 2016 was the last time I was in on the Nepal side. A lot of the people who die are those, if you will, who take the hook, line, and sinker for the low budget climbing right. expedition. So while the outside world might scorn at someone paying $100,000 for a one-on-one Western guide, I say that not to diminish any of the Eastern climbers, but let's just say an American guide, those people aren't dying. As if anything, the people paying more money are living because of the experience level. And so in terms of the low budget expedition companies, they're hiring Sherpa, who many of whom I've encountered directly, right. who have almost no experience at all. And not only that, don't know how to handle an adult man who says, I'm going to the summit. You're going to have to fight me for it. Okay, I quit. So these people are dying at higher rates because of that.
And case in point was the young Sherpa who was literally a trekking porter that got he got drafted to guide this Pakistani general from the Pakistani military. This kid was 18. He was in his 60s, and the Sherpa gave up all of his oxygen. They summited, but then they collapsed coming down, and thankfully some really strong super Sherpas saved their lives, and the young Sherpa lost both hands, amputated. The Pakistani general went back home and said that the Sherpa almost killed him, but look, I summited. So that's an exception, you know, but it's also illustrative of the dynamics going on. I kind of look at Everest over the years and kind of phases. You know, back there was the national teams, the British, the Swiss, the Americans, Italians went in, you know, those were the national teams. That's when, if one person summited, the whole team was a success. Then you had commercialization start with, you know, Hall and Ball and Kerry Kobler and Russell Bryce and Eric Simonson and, you know, that whole group back in the early 90s, and that progressed. And then around 2013, primarily coincident with the disaster on Manaslu, the Sherpas began to see that they were just as skilled because they've been climbing with those Western companies for 20 some odd years. And then true enough, I mean, they had 10, 15 summits of Everest. And from a climbing perspective, from knowing Everest, they were golden and are golden. They perhaps lack the skills to turn around an adult man or to recognize AMS as early and turn them around. So medical perhaps wasn't there, cultural language, but that progressed then from 2013 to almost 10 years later now. And so we saw, you know, companies, the Nepali companies just explode. And it went from 80% of the summits in 2010 being guided by Western companies, Australian, German, British, American, to 80% today getting to the summit with Nepali companies, and only 20% by that old guard. So it is completely flip-flopped. And now we're seeing this bifurcation amongst the Nepali guides. Now they are starting to play the airline game of, you know, United Airlines versus JetBlue, competing on price and service. So now you've got these high-end Nepali guides, which are absolutely legitimately asking $65,000 per client. And meanwhile, you've still got Nepali companies that are happy sitting at that 30, providing a base level of service. So, you know, I guess the good news is, just like, you know, JetBlue opened up an entire market, Ryanair, for people to, you know, go see their relatives, you know, not have to spend a fortune flying on airplanes. Now they've opened up a new market so that people can go climb in the Himalaya and not spend a fortune. But in some cases, it's come at this price of safety. And when I talk to some of the Nepali guys, not all of them by any stretch of the imagination, there are some great Nepali companies out there that I would send my family with in a second. But there are some that say, it's not our job to turn around a client. Our job is to get them on the mountain and they can do whatever they want to. And if they die, not our problem. So, but you've also got some Western companies that have kind of had that same attitude. And I obviously am not going to name names, but over the years, we've had some Western companies with that same type of attitude. I think, however, that's pretty negative. But I think, however, looking forward, I think the industry is kind of cleaning up its act relative to safety, mainly through the advancement of technology, weather forecasting, oxygen delivery systems, just, you know, the gear itself, the quality of the gear, and the Sherpas now, through mainly efforts like through the Khumbu Climbing Center, are becoming much more skilled. Their interpersonal communications have vastly improved, and their medical knowledge is also improving. And now we're seeing, you know, people with 20, 25 summits of Everest, and they're as good as any Western guide out there. So, you know, the world is changing. It's absolutely evolving. And I think as long as more people are able to enjoy the mountains and do it in a respectful way, leave no trace, other elements like that, then I say, you know, let's enjoy our planet, but let's be respectful of it.
Alan, your knowledge of Everest is vast and people seek you out for the factual information about it, but emotionally, not just Everest, but all the big mountains of the world, but emotionally and intellectually, you have a deep tie to it. And I would love for you to share with me what we were just talking about before the record button was hit. You actually got a somewhat of a late start in the game for high altitude mountaineering, as my cat makes an appearance.
I love him.
That's Simba. He is in dire need of attention. But yeah, tell me a little bit about that, because it's fascinating to get started. I was 27 and I thought I was late to the game.
Yeah, you know, I've got this consulting business where I help people, you know, get into mountaineering called Summit Coach. And one of the questions I often get are from people that are like 18 and they say, you know, Alan, I want to go climb Mount Everest. I don't have any money or any experience. And oh, by the way, I want to do it next year. Or I get the other end of the spectrum. I've got a 72-year-old client with his 59-year-old girlfriend, and they want to go do the 7 summits in 1 year. And she's done Kilimanjaro, and that's about it. But I also get the people in the middle that are in their early 40s, and, you know, they're successful in life, successful in personal relationships, but they've reached a point where they want to do something for themselves. And Tom, I've always believed that, at least for me, that my life is an equilateral triangle, and that all three sides, I'm never successful in doing this, but it's work, family, and me. And trying to keep that triangle balanced. And it's been situational, you know, throughout my entire life as I struggled to get that balance. But so when I began, you know, I got an electrical engineering degree from the University of Memphis in 1979. That'll date me. And, but I knew I was never going to be a good engineer, but I knew I had good communication skills and I could process a lot of information and kind of distill it down to what are the salient facts. So I went into sales with Hewlett Packard, and I did that in Dallas for about 8 years. And I moved here to Fort Collins, Colorado in the late 80s and eventually over to Europe in the late 90s. But that whole first, I don't know, 15, 20 years of my career, I was heads down workaholic, you know, work, family, nothing for me, nothing for family, all work. And, you know, and I was successful, but it came at a cost. And so I was in Geneva, Switzerland, running this really big organization. And I've told the story before, but so, you know, I had several thousand employees, $500 million in revenue, profit loss. And so my financial person came in, Muriel from France. And so she came in late July and she says, Alan, I will see you in September. And I have no idea where these accents come from. So I said, September, Muriel, what are you talking about? What happened to August? And she goes, oh, yes, that's right. You're an American. You don't have any idea about living your life. All you know how to do is to work. I'm French. We take off the month. We go to the beach. We go to the mountains. We're with family. We drink wine. We eat cheese. We get to know each other. We renew. We relax. And then I come back and I work hard again for you. Bye-bye. She turned around and walked away.
Wow.
You know, and I began to think about that. And I thought, you know what? She is exactly spot on. I mean, you know, my career was going well. Everything was going well on that one leg of the triangle. But so then I decided that, you know, I'd done a couple of 14,000 foot mountains here in Colorado, and I could look out my window in Geneva and see Mont Blanc. So I hired a French guide to take me up. And this guy, you know, he must have thought I was like, where did this guy come from? You know, but I fell in love with the whole atmosphere of climbing, the crunch of the crampons in the snow, seeing the sunrise from the summit, you know, the cold. I just fell in love with it, Tom, just fell in love with it. So I then did a trek to Everest Base Camp, and I saw the majesty of the Himalayas and the you know, Buddhism and the Sherpas and old ladies spinning prayer wheels and the little kids playing with sticks, happy as a clam. And, you know, I just realized that, you know, there's a lot more to this planet and to our existence in it and our ability to make a contribution than just get heads down, just working all the time. And that was an inflection point in my life. And it started at age 38.
That's absolutely fascinating. So you really did make a difference. And as a person who starts at 38, you'd figure to tag Everest would be enough, but you've done now 38 some odd expeditions. K2 is that, to me, is like doing Everest five times. And at the age of 58, however you knock that one off, that's actually something, that's a whole side note, I think, that we could talk about someday. So kind of trying to put a little bit of a bow and a ribbon on it real quick. Let me just ask you, talking about Leave No Trace, about a year and a half ago, I did a symposium, if you will, on the garbage crisis and the human waste crisis on Everest. It seems to me that a lot of the problem are people trying to get away with dumping garbage and human waste and getting by all the rules and regulations put in place. Do you have any thoughts on that and what might be the best way to keep the mountain clean moving forward?
You know, it's inexcusable to me. We have role models and case studies around the world. Aconcagua used to be just a poop pile. You know, Denali, the National Park Service has done a great job there. But even then, they would take the so-called clean mountain cans, which, you know, you poop in a bag. They would then take those bags on the way down and throw them into a crevasse. And so now studies are showing the groundwater is being polluted in the general area of Denali. So they're stopped that practice. We're now finally learning how to do it. You know, Elbrus is still just horrible. Kilimanjaro, they've got toilets on it, but it also is pretty bad. Everest, you know, the Chinese have done, to your point, opening it up. They've done a fairly decent job of understanding that, you know, if you destroy your mountain, then you're going to destroy a cash cow. It doesn't hurt that they're building this huge mountaineering museum in Tengri, you know, in order to attract people on a high-speed train from Beijing, you know, to turn Everest on the north side into Disneyland, you know, but you know, they're cleaning up the mountain. That's the senior point. Nepal, yeah. Plenty of opportunity for improvement. You know, I was talking to one Nepali company. I said, why don't you use blue bags, wag bags, you know, basically the plastic bag that you poop in and then have your clients bring it down. And they said, oh no, that's $1 a bag. And you know how many bags we'd use? So raise your price by $50. I don't know a single climber in the world that wouldn't pay an extra $50 to keep the mountain clean. And, you know, the lower camps are getting better and better, but the high camp, like at the South Col, is just, you know, the problem is that I remember being there and I asked him, you know, where do I go, you know, do a number two? And the guy goes, anywhere. I'm like, really?
Yeah.
You know, and so you walk around and you see just these little turds frozen into the ground because there's only a third of the oxygen it doesn't disintegrate, doesn't deteriorate. And the wind, it's not strong enough, even though it's 150 miles an hour, because it's frozen into the ground. So you've got this, you know, this turd field at the South Coal, which is disgusting.
Yeah. So that's the garbage thing. Alan, tell me about you. Do you have any future plans? Are you going to go back climbing, or are you more of a summit coach? Cause summit coaching is a part of your business. What ambitions do you have for the future in terms of mountaineering?
I can say with 99.9% certainty, my 8,000 meter days are over. You know, July 12th. In 15 days, I turned 66. Mm-hmm. I just went on Medicare last year, damn it. You know, so, but I have been incredibly lucky. I mentioned this before we started recording that, you know, I was born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee, at elevation 318, and to have climbed the mountains that I have, the only word I have is gratitude. And I've been able to parlay my passion of mountain climbing with a purpose of being an Alzheimer's advocate to honor my mother, Ida, who died from Alzheimer's, and to use that to, I think, have a life that I never, ever dreamed of. And so I'm now at, I've kind of done Alan 1.0, Alan 2.0, and I'm now kind of in the design phase of Alan 3.0. And I think the catchphrase would be to give back. I have been given a gift and I feel a responsibility to be able to give back. And I, you know, one of the ways is through the ongoing chronicling of, you know, the high altitude climbs and trying to be transparent and authentic in my reporting, not to be sensationalized and just, you know, be respectful of everybody there, do my part to contribute to helping make these mountains a cleaner, safer place to the extent that I have any ability to influence, but I do my best. And then to, you know, to work with people, especially young people. You know, Tom, I'm very concerned that climate change is changing the composition of all of these mountains. We're seeing it this year. I just got a message this morning that people on Gasher Braum 2, that it is just, it's mush on the mountains. You know, anchors are giving out. They're rappelling and scared to death because they're afraid the anchor is going to give out because it's so warm on the mountain. They just stopped climbing on Nanga Parbat for the same reason, rain at 5,000 meters, which is unheard of at this time of year. As horrible as that is, I see an opportunity, and that is for the younger generation, the ones that are probably 12 years old now, that when they're 20, not 38, that they go to these same mountains that we've been celebrating and enjoying for centuries or for at least decades, that they go and they pioneer new routes that are safer and more doable. Probably in our lifetime, the Western Coombe and the Khumbu Icefall will become unclimbable. I'm pretty sure of that. Just because of, the melting of the snow, the movement of the glacier, the size of the crevasses. So then Nepal is going to have to make a decision, and the community will, that is taking a helicopter into camp too. Is that considered appropriate? I mean, they take a helicopter now into base camp, and 50 years ago, you never would have done that. You know, 30 years ago, you wouldn't have done that. So maybe that's part of, an inconvenient trend that we're going to see things having to change to accommodate the world in which we live. I'm not going to sit here and say it's right or wrong, but I will sit here and say that it's probably going to happen. And then we're going to have to make a decision whether climbing in a style that was appropriate 50 years ago, which is today suicidal, you know, why would you go do that when you have an alternative? And so we'll see what happens.
Right.
This is now the third year in a row China has closed to climbing. And I'm hearing rumors they're going to close it again next year or keep it closed. So
that's an interesting topic, because when we, Mark Sinnott, Renan Ozturk, and I, we lucked out. We got there in 2019 and nobody's been back. Yeah. And all these people, well, we should go search for Irvin's body over here, see if they could do the Norton Couloir route. Good luck. You might never get your shot. This might be generations away.
China
has a different set of rules.
I think it is. I love the whole Mark's book is back on my top shelf
right
here, and I love the book. I love your story, what you guys did, and I think you were looking for a ghost, though. I don't think the bones were there. So
I think you're right. I think you're right. Well, as Mark said, we talked not that long ago when he got this tip that supposedly.
Yeah.
The 60 team had seen Irvin and removed, but then the body was removed some years later. He goes, gosh, if National Geographic had heard that story before we left, they would have pulled the plug. I'm like, whoa. I mean, that would have saved us a lot of problems, I suppose, but nobody wants the plug pulled on an expedition. So good that information eased its way out.
And it's such a great story in adventure history, right up there with Shackleton and, you know, all the great polar explorations. And I mean, just, you know, did they die going up or down? And did their oxygen systems work? And how did they manage to get that high? And what happened? Where'd they go? I just love it. I'm just captivated by the mystery of it. And personally, I hope it's never solved. But I love the fact that we don't know, and that it gives everybody a chance to have an opinion on it, and we can, you know, discuss it endlessly.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's to have there be an unsolved mystery, and maybe it is the mystery of Mallory and Irvin. It's not unlike that idea of the mystery of life, right? It keeps people dreaming, pursuing. Coming up with ideas in their head, and it gives them some zest. And so I agree with you. I first of all, I don't think we're ever going to solve it, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It keeps people searching.
Yeah. I always wanted to go climb on the north side. I went to the south side four times, and in 2008, I was all set to go, had my tickets, you know, everything ready. Then the Chinese closed the north side because of the Olympics. And they wanted the torch up to the top. And so, you know, they paid Nepal $30 million to shut down. And, you know, I've got a picture of a guy walking around with a rifle at the Camp 2 on Everest and part of the Nepali army. And they were there. They confiscated our satellite phones. It was repulsive. I mean, it was everything that you never want politically on a mountain. It had been so politicized. We were seeing Chinese fighter jets flying over the summit. And then they did a live broadcast of the team taking the torch to the summit. And then they said, okay, now you can climb. It was surreal. It was surreal.
So that was on the south side at Camp 2. So at 21,000 feet, there was a guy with an army guy with a machine gun.
Or with a long gun. And I remember they confiscated our satellite phones. And so we had to go put them into this blue barrel, you know, one of the poop barrels. And so if you wanted to use it, you had to go over and take your sat phone out. And then they would stand next to you and listen. And I became the ugly American. I was like, I was just really upset, just, you know, very frustrated at my wit's end. And so I'm talking and I look, this guy standing right there just staring at me. I said, here, do you want to talk to my wife? Do you want to talk to my wife? And the guy was like, you know, and I was kind of looking back at that. That was not one of my better moments, but.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I have a lot of people reach out to me and say, oh, there's no way the Chinese would ever have removed the body of Mallory or Irvin or anybody for that matter. And I say, in 2008, they closed the mountain just to take debris and bodies off. So there you go.
I think I've learned in my 65.9 years is never say never.
Right on. All right. I've taken up enough of your time. Alan, it's so always great to see you. Perhaps we will cross paths in Namche Bazaar or wherever someday on a trek into base camp.
I will buy you a martini at one of the new bars in Namche next time we're there.
Oh, I might just have to order a double.
It's no longer a beer. Now it's a martini. So.
I love that. I'm intrigued. Let's make it happen real soon.
Okay, my friend. Hey, it was an honor being here on your podcast. I appreciate you reaching out to me.
Martinis in the Kumbu, times sure have changed. Alan, I will take you up on that. Looking forward to it. If you want to reach out to Alan Arnett, you should check out his website, blog, and podcast on alanarnett.com. It is well worth your time if you are interested in anything that's Everest or 8,000 meter peak related. He is a good man. He knows what he's talking about, and he does his research. Check him out. You're going to enjoy it. Thank you for being here. If you haven't already, please click subscribe. If you don't want to subscribe, no worries. Come back often. Let me know about what you think about this video and the others. Peace out. Have a great day.